You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 4th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to The Review, your weekly dose of cultural opinion here on Monocle 24, broadcasting from Studio One at Midori House, with me, Emma Nelson, and Andrew Muller.
Today we'll be glancing through a few of the films, including some possible Oscar contenders, which will be gracing a screen near you this month.
If you want to survive, do and say as little as possible.
Well, I don't want to survive. I want to live.
We'll hear more about 12 Years a Slave a little later on. And if you've had a disappointing selection of books over Christmas, we'll give you some new recommendations for this new year. And we'll also take a trip to Caracas.
We've always thought of the bookstore as this kind of box of light, you know, kind of just illuminating to the street and inviting people to come in.
And if you've shied away from world music before now for fear of being mistaken for the kind of person who wears socks with sandals, our guest music reviewer Elizabeth Kinder will be joining us in the studio to explain why you've been misguided.
Throw in a stop-off in Auckland, and it's a jam-packed hour ahead coming up here on The Review on Monocle 24. So welcome back after the new year. How was your cultural Christmas, Andrew?
Blessedly uneventful. I did catch up with a TV series I'd been meaning to catch up with for ages, which is, it's slightly silly but hugely enjoyable. Justified, based on very, very loosely extrapolated from an Elmore Leonard short story. But I'm way behind on this. It's now four seasons old, but it is another take on the Maverick Lawman who does it all his own way kind of thing. But it is. It's for people who still haven't found anything to replace The Wire, it will kind of do. It's not as good, but it is hugely entertaining.
It is the season of binge watching. How many episodes did you plough through?
Quite a few.
What time was bedtime in the Muller household?
Well, mostly, I've been staying up quite late, mostly gloating at the cricket.
Nah.
But that doesn't really count as a cultural experience. No. Well, it kind of does where I come from. And you?
I indulged in my cultural binging as well. I sat on the sofa and watched an awful lot of movies. I found the rental section of our satellite television thing, something that I didn't even know existed, and I stumbled across it one evening, and within the space of 4 days, caught up on all the movies that I should have seen but missed. Behind the Candelabra, which I thought was amazing, the Michael Douglas is blisteringly funny portrayal of Liberace and his boyfriend Matt Damon. Lake Quartet, which is a wonderful, wonderful, understated and simple and very funny film as well, even though it is all about death and people falling to bits. The Great Gatsby, which I thought was possibly one of the most bonkers and weird films and was massively unimpressed by it. I was really looking forward to it and then just found it. Baz Luhrmann, please just give Mr. Scott Fitzgerald a little bit of respect. And the best one I thought was Monsters University, which I watched on New Year's Eve with a bottle of gin, and it wasn't very good at all, but it was all I really wanted to do on New Year's Eve. So that was my cultural thing. It was spent on the sofa catching up with things that I should have done. It was kind of like homework.
I can think of many things I would ask Baz Luhrmann to do, but they mostly revolve around the theme of something else.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We do films next. Because January is, in fact, a great time for cinema, with the Oscars just weeks off and the Northern Hemisphere cursed with cold weather. Many of us are looking to the big screen for entertainment.
And this month we're being entertained by a power-hungry banker, a sex addict and a man sold into slavery. And that's just today's guest reviewer. Welcome back, Tim Robey.
You forgot the guy who comes up with AIDS medicine in the 1980s as well.
There is that one as well.
There's that as well.
But you don't want to build your pot up too much.
But we will start with the power-hungry baker.
Baker? That would be even better.
I would watch.
Leonardo DiCaprio in a three-hour-long epic about a power-hungry baker.
I am totally going to pitch that to somebody. A film about a power-hungry baker. We could call it The Buns of Navarone, perhaps. The Wolf of Wall Street, it has been criticised, not least by Christina McDowell, a daughter of one of the people on whom the film is based, for glorifying psychopathic behaviour, it says here in scare quotes, which leads me to suspect she's not seen terribly many of Scorsese's films.
That's true. I was also kind of dreading this film, because actually 3 hours of Leonardo DiCaprio as a corrupt investment banker with Scorsese kind of going full cocaine. Mm. I just thought it was going to be truly exhausting.
Well, I loved Casino.
So did I.
Because it was exhausting, but I get absolutely your reservations about DiCaprio, having seen Gatsby in the last couple of days and actually wondered what the point of DiCaprio is.
And not just that, actually, but the last few Scorsese films where I feel as though he's slightly started to sag. I mean, Hugo was just needlessly long. Shutter Island, I thought, was just kind of a nothing, really. So I was pretty concerned about this one, but he's got his groove back. Scorsese has got his groove back. He's energized by this. You can tell it's really snappy. There's more kind of virtuoso technique going on in it than we've seen in his films for a long time without that annoying kind of CGI overkill that Hugo had. It's actually really exciting and very funny. And Leonardo is probably better cast than he's been in anything, at least since The Departed, which I thought he was quite good in.
So briefly explain the plot to us.
So Leonardo is a thrusting youngster who comes in at the bottom end of one of these firms and is quickly propelled to the top and starts indulging in all the kind of stuff that you'd expect an investment banker to be doing, i.e. terrible, terrible, illegal stuff, which they kind of justify as not totally illegal because it doesn't seem as though it is. They're exploiting a loophole, and then the FBI come onto them, and then it all becomes a big paranoid kind of coke-fueled spiral into chaos and degradation and hell, essentially. But it's really funny too.
But this character or characters like this, there's such a recurring theme in American life and indeed in American art. There's a pantheon of them: Charles Foster Kane, Gordon Gekko. I mean, you can fill in your own favorites. And Scorsese has tackled similar characters, usually of the underworld variety. Where does Wolf of Wall Street fit in to his pantheon? It does sound like a very Scorsese film.
It really is. I mean, it's Scorsese kind of like pulling out all the stops again in a way that we've lacked. We haven't had him do that for a while. I think it's following on from the kind of Gordon Gekko greed is good mantra, and it's updating it, you know, 20-odd years. It's basically saying, where have we gone with this? And how has the American kind of financial system allowed this to be perpetuated? But also, how are these particular characters allowed to be so integral to it? And Leonardo is such a totally amoral kind of douchebag in this film. He's awful. He's irredeemable.
So he's asking the question, what is it about the possibility of vast sums of money which attracts amoral psychopaths?
Well, that's one of the questions he's asking. But he's also asking how do we allow this to continue? And also, where do they get their kind of weird esprit de corps? Because it's everyone at the firm loves him, and they're kind of crying when he makes this speech where he says he's going to have to leave. They're crying. They love the guy. He enables them to make all these vast sums. And it's this sort of strange mass hypnosis that they seem to have got into. And suddenly the rug is pulled out from under them by the FBI, and the movie kind of enters this final act. But I think it's really good.
Let's have a listen.
My name is Jordan Belfort. The year I turned 26, I made $49 million, which really pissed me off because it was three shy of a million a week.
We're making a name for ourselves. Nobody knows if the stock is going to go up, down, sideways, or in circles. You know what a fugazi is?
Oh, Pugazi. It's a fake.
Hey, Fugazi, Fugazi. It's a wazi, it's a woozy, it's a fairy dust.
Was all this legal? Absolutely not. We were making more money than we knew what to do with.
We don't work for you, man.
Yeah, my money taped to your boobs. Technically, you do work for me.
A little trip of The Wolf of Wall Street by Martin Scorsese, the director. Tim Robey, you said that he was making a commentary on it. What I've always enjoyed about Scorsese films is that he doesn't judge. I mean, does he in this one?
I don't think there's any overt judging. We're just kind of presented with this kind of awful range of behavior, and we're kind of like, I mean, the stuff that women kind of go through in this film is pretty appalling. For instance, I mean, they're paraded around the office half naked, you know, cocaine is snorted off every part of them you can imagine, and that's kind of their entire function, except for the character of Leonardo's wife, who is a bit similar to the kind of Sharon Stone in Casino model of a woman who's sort of on board, but then as soon as everything starts to go shaky, she's out the door. And it's the same with Lorraine Bracco in Goodfellas. There's that tradition, and Kathy Moriarty in Raging Bull as well, that tradition of kind of Scorsese wife characters. She fits into that. But Leonardo, I think, is really well cast in this, because there's something kind of like I find him quite unsympathetic, in fact, and that was a problem for me in Great Gatsby. He was no great revelation in Great Gatsby, and his charm, I think, is quite skin deep, but that works for this character. He's sort of a snake oil type, and that really does work. Matthew McConaughey, who we heard in that clip, has one scene, essentially, which is brilliant. I mean, it's one of the best scenes he's ever shot. He's the guy who kind of lures Leo into the whole mindset of this and kind of gives him the kind of inside track. And they just have this one lunch scene, and it lays out the stall for the rest of the film at the beginning.
Let's move on to another film which sort of lays out its stall in a very different way, Nymphomaniac, the latest offering from Lars von Trier, obviously another vehicle for his muse, Charlotte Gainsbourg. The last one, Antichrist, that wasn't a film I'd like to see again, thank you very much.
Well, we've
for some very, very obvious reasons.
That was the last one between those two, and then in between there was Melancholia, the Kirsten Dunst
again
film.
With Charlotte Gainsbourg again.
She pops up too, yeah, as the sister. But this one, the thing about this one is that it's incredibly long. I mean, it's 4 hours long, and they're splitting it into two films.
Right.
Lars's original version of it was, in fact, I think 5.5 hours long, and an hour and a half of that has been cut out. And you imagine that it's probably because it's just too explicit to be shown or something, but it's not. It's just because the producers and financiers realize that they can't possibly, this is not commercially viable for them to release a 5.5 hour long film. So they've cut it down to two hour films, a bit like Kill Bill, or in fact like Che. They've cut it down into two halves. And it's Lars's kind of most, it's his magnum opus. It's his attempt to kind of explore sex and what it does to the psyche. And it begins with Charlotte Gainsbourg basically beaten up on the street. And she tells the whole story of her sex life from, would you believe, the age of 2, and continues right through to that point. And we go through everything, and we go through her kind of history of sex obsession. And the kind of point it's making is that she's like the sum of her sexual experiences. But it is wildly explicit, and he's using digital techniques to splice together the real actors with porn stars who are kind of
it's pretty graphic.
Yeah. I didn't think it was, I mean, I'd been told it was just this avalanche of sex all the way through and that we were going to be seeing everything constantly throughout, and if you go in looking for that, then I think you'd probably be disappointed, but because it's quite kind of dramatically gritty
as
well.
Cool.
And it's got the usual kind of Lars von Trier kind of alienation all the way through it. I think basically if you don't like Lars von Trier, you will despise this. Don't go near it. Don't touch it. So, Andrew,
it's not anywhere close to the top of my list. But, I mean, to what extent do you think at this point von Trier relishes the idea that his films are something of an obstacle course, that this is something that you endure rather than actually enjoy?
I think he does relish that, and I think he would feel that he'd failed if he made a film that everyone liked. Basically, if everyone hates it, he's kind of happy. But if everyone liked it, he would think, what have I done wrong?
Let's have a little listen to this joy fest.
What do I do?
Smile, make eye contact.
But what if it doesn't work?
If you have to talk, remember to ask lots of work questions if you want more than a yes or no answer. That'll just happen on its own. You just take them to the lavatory and you have sex with them.
What if it's nasty?
And you just think of the bag of chocolate sweeties.
The very menacing voice of Joe there, played by Charlotte Gainsbourg in Nymphomaniac, a film whose title pretty much sums up 4 hours. I mean, it's not too long since we had a 4-hour lesbian epic in Blue is the Warmest Colour. I mean, are we spotting a pattern here, Tim? Is 2014 going to be a lengthy erotic spell?
I know you weren't a fan of Blue is the Warmest Colour. I think you've added an hour to its running time in your memory. It was actually only 3 hours. But yeah, we're definitely pushing boundaries. And this film does that. And it does it with quite known actors as well. I mean, we have people like Christian Slater. He's not involved in the sex scenes, but he plays Charlotte Gainsbourg's dad. Shia LaBeouf is very much involved in the sex scenes. He's this kind of recurring figure who keeps coming back through her life. And it's very odd to see these kind of name actors popping in and out of what's sort of basically hardcore porn. I mean, hardcore porn with digital trickery to kind of enhance it. Quite surgically kind of cut so that you don't see too much for too long at any point, you know. But you kind of get enough glimpses to know pretty much what's going on. I think that the weird thing about the film is that the first half of it is building this case for kind of liberated sex as sort of like you can explore, and it kind of makes you a rounder person, that she's an explorer, she's adding to the sum of herself with all these experiences. But the second half makes you feel very differently. It makes you feel as though this is, in fact, sucked away her ability to, sorry to use that verb, but to love anyone and to really kind of have any sort of meaning or soul in her life. So it's sort of an uphill and then a downhill situation.
Let's move on to 12 Years a Slave, which is hotly tipped to sweep the board at this year's Oscars. Absolutely at the top of the list of the Oscar for Best Actor contest is Chiwetel Ejiofor as the protagonist in A True Story. We had Django Unchained last year, a couple of years ago now, which was Tarantino's take on slavery. This is a very, very different one, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I'm stuck selling films to you that I can't make sound fun, but I think 12 Years a Slave is like totally unmissable.
Right.
In a way that Django Unchained kind of wasn't quite. The problem with that was that it was ahistorical, Django Unchained. It was a revenge fantasy. So it was sort of, we set up slavery and then we knock it down in this way that we wish we could have done back then. What 12 Years a Slave is in fact showing you how it was and how inescapable it was. And showing you that in a way that really cinema hasn't dealt with very successfully. If you think about films about slavery, it's usually white people in wigs talking about, debating slavery. It's William Wilberforce, it's Amistad, it's that's the thing. It's of
course, and they do always have that redemptive aspect to them. There's a happy ending. The white men in the wigs fix everything.
That's right. Yeah, and I mean, 12 Years a Slave kind of tips you off from the beginning that you know how long this ordeal is going to last. And the memoir it's based on, which was written in 1853 by this guy Solomon Northup, it's about the 12 years that he spent as a slave. He was abducted from his wife and family as a freed man and sold into slavery in Louisiana. And he went through that for 12 years and he had no way of contacting his loved ones or getting anyone to help him out of this. So it kind of puts you through that experience and you do kind of come out the other side and you've experienced it with him. Chiwetel is incredible in this film. I think he should certainly win Best Actor. I think he's a wonderful actor, but this is easily the biggest opportunity he's ever had in a film to kind of strut his stuff. And the supporting cast is also terrific. Michael Fassbender plays the kind of most, I guess, the most vicious or perverse of the like plantation owners that he comes into contact with. But it's a man, it's quite a complex performance because he's not just purely kind of ruthlessly evil. He's someone whose moral sanity has just been stripped away by the fact that he's allowed to do this. You know, he has these slaves, he has these dozens of slaves living on his ranch and he can wake them up at midnight and make them dance for him. And this is something that is legal and fine.
There is something about the film that many people have noticed is that it's not necessarily not judgmental, but it's very cool in its portrayal of what happens. And things are just played out in front of your eyes. You don't get the impression that any argument is being driven here. Obviously, we know what is happening is barbaric, but because it is so coolly directed, it actually becomes even more harrowing.
I think so, yeah, and it's certainly not kind of sentimentalized or those kind of emotional notes are not hit in the way that Spielberg or someone might have hit them. I mean, Steve McQueen is a very interesting visual artist, and the shot choices that he makes in this film, there's a very long shot where we see Solomon being strung from the bough of this tree all day, and the camera just holds on it, and you just feel the duration of his suffering, basically, in this shot. It's an extraordinary sequence. Also, I think there are little arguments sort of threaded in and out of the film, and the screenplay by John Ridley is really clever at doing this because he does great justice to the book, but he also inserts little things here and there. For instance, he talks about how there's a total lack of solidarity between the slaves. You know, at the beginning, one of them gets to escape from the ship. You know, his master comes to rescue him. And Solomon has become a buddy with this guy, and he's calling after him. He just ignores him totally and just walks off because there's nothing he can do. And this kind of these failures of solidarity are interesting because it doesn't turn it into just a kind of simplistic white versus black kind of narrative. It's great on so many levels, this film. I think it should storm the Oscars, and I think it's one for the ages.
Tim Robey, thank you very much indeed for all your contributions here on The Review in the last year. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll have a short break now and we'll get the first instalment of our reading recommendations. First stop, Caracas next.
There's a saying in Mexico, for everything bad, mezcal. For everything good, the same. Monocle Films visits Oaxaca to meet the people injecting new life in an ancient beverage, taking mezcal from small Mexican villages to the world's capital.
Most mezcals are produced by families in their villages, in small batches using traditional methods handed down through generations. Mezcal is traditionally a farmer's drink, a working-class spirit, but it's also one steeped in folklore and a particularly Mexican sense of magic and mysticism.
Liquid Courage, in the film's menu on Monocle.com.
Now, Lugar Común, or Common Place, is an independent bookshop in Caracas. Located in the upper-class district of Altamira, the shop doubles as a coffee house and also opens late every night to host readings, workshops and lectures. It's a bit of a rarity in a city where such cultural places are hard to find.
Lugar Común was set up by three young people who also own a small independent publishing house. Alberto Moreo is one of them. We sent Irena Caselli to meet him and ask for a few recommendations.
Come in, welcome. Leave that ruckus outside.
Welcome to Lugar Común. This is our bookstore. As you can see, it's two floors. It's always nice to come into this kind of small bubble that we have and leave that noisy street outside. My name is Alberto Morreo. I am the actual Büchermensch, as we say in German, right? And man of books of this bookstore, Lugar Común, which means commonplace. It's a funny name, but I think it works out very well for our goal and here in Caracas currently. The bookstore opened 13th of December in 2012. So we run this publishing house that started about 3 years ago, also called Lugar Común. So we started printing books, editing books, and create like mainly a new narrative and poetry as well. And we also have like children's book, which we're quite proud of as well. We've always thought of the bookstore as this kind of box of light, you know, kind of just illuminating to the street and inviting people to come in and share this kind of craziness of light that we have here with books. We open the entire day from 10, usually to 9 p.m. because we do drink a bit here, a lot of wine, and always people are invited to come by with a bottle of wine and share with us. We have this book that I always like to show that's called Los Caracteres Tipográficos y su Historia, which would be the typographic characters and their history, by Ernesto Armitano. Armitano was like this Italian, very old school, he was also like a black belt, very funny character, very serious as well, but he was like the best publisher here in Venezuela for years. And you know, every artist in Venezuela had an Armitano book. And he was also called like the king of the coffee table books. They always talk about this before and after in editing history in Venezuela with Armitano. And when we started the bookstore, we decided to buy all Armitano books. He passed away, sadly, in 2007. And since then, his books, you know, have just been like selling like cheap, very cheap, and you know, just kind of very badly distributed around the country. So we started with Armitano. I thought it was kind of our first kind of thing we had to do. And when we bought mainly all Armitano, we found this amazing book called Los Caracteres Tipográficos, which is in Spanish, incunable, which is books before the beginning of print, you know. So it's this kind of beautiful history that's got this kind of black velvet kind of thing to it. On top, it's for kind of this Gutenberg effect that you can see it on top. And all the pages are cut by hand. It's like in cotton, and it's serialized. It's just only like 400-500 books in the world, and we have them all. And since people found out that we have that book, you know, it's been of course a top sell as well. We have this amazing reader who is a security guard in a nightclub, and he always comes like before he's going to a club because he hates working there. So he always buys like Gombrich and History of Art and, you know, amazing books. And then you have to picture him like working outside a nightclub just reading, you know, it's amazing. And his name is Dionisio, so you have to love him. Since Armitano has been a big thing for us, and that way, like art books, Venezuelan art history, collectibles, old used books, and also very new books as well, all comes through here. So you can find all kinds of people looking for all this kind of material. I think that this kind of commonplace, Lugar Común, will survive. We hope it will survive. And if not, like every bookstore, we would live in its myth. And we're glad we created a bit of a myth here for Caracas.
Alberto Morillo there, the co-founder of Lugar Común, or Commonplace Bookstore in Caracas. We'll return to the subject of publishing later on, as we'll be discussing some new book releases for the year with the booksellers Kathy Ransombrick at the end of the show.
You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Emma Nelson. Now, it's probably time that someone thought of a new name for the genre which has become known as world music, largely because it isn't really a genre at all, and the phrase is more a somewhat unhelpful means of referring to the vast and diverse vista of music not made by white guys with electric guitars.
Well, our guest music reviewer this week appreciates the subtleties of what might be found in the world music racks of your local record store better than most. Elizabeth Kinder writes with F Roots magazine. That's the right way to say it, is it?
It is.
You better not say another way.
No.
We got in trouble last time. Elizabeth, a very warm welcome to the studio. Thank you very much indeed for coming. Happy New Year. Andrew just then mentioned the way that world music has perhaps become the worst name possible for the genre that you enjoy so much.
Well, yes, I think the problem, as he pointed out, is that it's not a generic term. It's actually started off as a marketing term because when it became sort of much more heard and available sort of during the 1980s. They needed a rack in the record store. They needed somewhere for the records to go. And so that's how, and that was the best term that they could come up with at the time that included everything that basically is not in English. I think that's key. It isn't just about white guys with guitars. That's just because there are quite a few of them who do play world music. But I think it's the language thing that's key.
How much do you think what has become world music suffered from that? And also it did acquire certain associations with a certain beard-scratching, cardigan-clad worthiness as well.
It did. I think that was because in the 80s it was really popular in all the clubs. And as it became more widely known, it started to move into the concert halls. And it became employed as people got sort of fed up with rock and roll and the guys singing about their spots and love life. They wanted something extra. They wanted something more that spoke to them more about their interests and their lifestyle. And so I think it became a kind of political and lifestyle choice rather than about the music. And you've got this amazing, diverse, fantastic music from all over the world that isn't played on the mainstream media here, simply because it's not in English.
There's a little bit, though, that seeps quite disappointingly into the mainstream, which you get those little compilations that you find at the checkouts of ladies' clothes shops, or when you go to chains of slightly odd restaurants and they say, if you like the world music that we were playing you over your funny burger, why not buy the CD or why not sign to iTunes? It seems to have been embraced in many ways commercially improperly. I mean, do you find sometimes it you actually get world music still hasn't got itself a good reputation simply because of the bad CDs?
I do think that's an issue, actually, but I think it's a kind of a lack of education because it's not available. It's not widely available. You can't, if you didn't know about it, if you didn't actually think, I'm going to seek it out, then you just won't hear it because you don't get it on the mainstream media.
The education is important, of course. I mean, it's entirely my problem, not the genres, but I always find myself feeling a little bit suspicious that even if I hear something that might be referred to as this, as I really like, just think, am I listening to the Ethiopian equivalent to Gary Barlow here?
Does that matter?
Yeah.
It does if you sort of touch down in Addis and say, I've been listening to such and such, and everyone just points and laughs at you. I mean, there is that desire occasionally, I think perhaps more on Andrew's part than on mine, to maintain a healthy edge of underground.
Yeah, I know, but I think it's like maybe the Gary Barlow leads you into the deeper waters.
One would hope so.
Straight into the sea, as far as I can see. Right, let's have a listen to some of this amazing music that you've brought in with us. You wanted to talk about a lady called Rebecca Malope. Tell us about her.
Well, actually, Rebecca Malope, she's a South African gospel singer. And so that is South African elements, musical elements, that's mixed with church music, Christian Zionist churches that went throughout South Africa. But the real reason I brought Rebecca Malope in today is because she is track 14 on Charlie Gillett's World 2003 CD. And I did want to say a word about Charlie because he was so inspirational and so brilliant, and he had such an open mind. And he had this absolute talent for putting together music that would sort of reassure you, because they'd have some sort of familiarity to it, but it would be so new and exciting at the same time. And he had this fantastic facility of putting tracks together that just kind of lead you through this amazing, I hate to say journey, but it was an amazing journey on each CD. And your mind and your heart and your ears had just opened to these fabulous sounds. And that's how I came across Rebecca Malope, track 14, Charlie Gillett's World 2003 CD.
Charlie Gillett being a broadcaster who died about 3 or 4 years ago, didn't he? He was a man who pioneered bringing world music to a lot of the British ears.
Yeah.
How far he travelled, I'm not entirely sure. But let's have a listen to Rebecca Malope.
That was Rebecca Malope with Inambolo Yachingo, the first selection of this week's guest music review here on The View. Elizabeth Kinder from Fruits magazine. The next track you've brought along, a band I know slightly, or know of slightly, Dvochka, who are from, I believe, Denver, Colorado, yeah. I think I'm right in saying, though they don't necessarily sound it.
No, they don't. although they do have guitars. Nick Urata's grandparents... Nick is the lead singer in Dvochka and one of the main writers. And his grandparents were Italian. And as he was growing up, he listened to a lot of Italian folk music. And I think it was his grandfather who had a massive accordion that he used to play. And so he was really influenced by that. And also by Eastern European folk, Balkan sort of gypsy folk music. So that's all mixed in. And the track that I want to play, You Love Me, is from How It Ends. And he was inspired to write this music through traveling through the desert of Arizona. And when he got back to his Denver, bedsit or wherever he was living, he wanted to get back to this fantastic landscape. And so he was trying to get back there through the music, and was rather surprised sometime later when one of the directors of Little Miss Sunshine got in touch with him and said, that he wanted him to write the music for his film, because on hearing the music that he'd written, it had brought to this director's mind a little band travelling through the Arizona desert. And then when Nick went to see the footage, he realised that it was shot along the same roads that they'd been touring along that had inspired the music in the first place. And I wanted to say that, you know, music sort of is redolent of place in the most extraordinary ways.
And the rest, of course, for anyone who saw Little Miss Sunshine, it's history. Let's have a listen to Dvochka, You Love Me. Dvochka there, You Love Me, the first track from their album from 2004, How It Ends. It's one of the music choices of Elizabeth Kinder. She writes for F-Roots magazine on world music. You also apparently play the mean tenor saxophone in a rock and roll band.
I do.
I'm afraid we don't have a great amount of time to talk about your own saxophone playing, but let's move on to Amira. That's your next choice. Why did you decide to bring Amira in?
Amira is a really extraordinary musician and singer from Sarajevo. And the reason I brought her in is because I interviewed her recently for F-Roots magazine, and that will be coming out later on this year. And it was the only interview I've ever done where I've just been sitting there in tears. I mean, because she was talking about her experience during the war in Sarajevo, when under the siege. The front line was in her garden, in her parents' house. She spent 4 years in a basement with her Serbian neighbours, you know, taking pot shots at them every time they went out to get food and threatening to kill them. And if you go to Sarajevo now, you will find that there's a lot of hatred for the Serbian. There's a lot of division still. And Amira... really, through her music, her main aim is to create unity and remind everybody of this fantastic multicultural city that they all lived very happily in before the war. And so she works with musicians from all over the Balkans, and she has picks sort of traditional folk songs from the different countries and sort of brings them all together. And her particular genre that she sings in is called Sevda, which is a bit like, I suppose you would say, you could say it was a sort of Bosnian flamenco. It's about passion and joy and melancholy. And she sort of makes it very relevant. And here in this song, it's from her latest album, Amulet. In this, she's, she's working with this piano player, jazz piano player, Boran Zed, who's a Serbian musician.
Let's have a listen to the track. It's called Yano Mori.
Yano Mori.
That was Yano Mori, the track of the artist from Sarajevo, Amira. That's on her album Amulet from last year. 2 years ago now. I keep forgetting that we've had a 2014 arrive in the last couple of days.
And unfortunately, that is all we have time for from this week's guest reviewer here on The Review, Elizabeth Kinder from Fruit Magazine. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, for our final city look ahead on The Review, we're going to turn our attention to a lady who normally sits behind the glass with us here on Studio One. Claire Urban faithfully mans the sound desk for The Review, but what listeners may not be aware of is that her native homeland is New Zealand, where she headed for Christmas.
And she is now sharing some insider tips with us. Here is what you could be getting up to in Auckland should you happen to find yourself there over the coming days.
While the Northern Hemisphere celebrates the New Year in thermals, in the Southern Hemisphere, New Zealanders are lighting up their barbies, opening bottles of crisp white wine, and digging their toes into the hot sand. And when the sun's out in New Zealand, we go to the beach, which is always only a short journey away. From central Auckland Harbour, take the early morning ferry to Waiheke Island. Mentioned in issue 60 of Monocle around this time last year, Waiheke Island is a 35-minute ferry trip from central Auckland and offers a handful of restaurants, cafes, markets and outdoor things to do. My pick is the Whittaker's Musical Museum, which features a plethora of historical and unique instruments which you can play around with. There is a live show at 1:30 p.m. during which you can see how the professionals do it. Once you've had enough of the island life, get yourself back to Auckland CBD to the cobblestone Vulcan Lane, a humming area which dates back to the 1800s. Boasting some of Auckland's more innovative eating establishments, foodies the world over will be in heaven. And for the theatre thirsty, on Saturday and Sunday, within the grounds of Ascension Wine Estate, Melbourne's Essential Theatre Company will perform A Midsummer Night's Dream. Entitled Shakespeare in the Vines, the evening offers a surreal performance under the stars, coupled with a three-course meal and some of New Zealand's finest wines. And depending on your preference, Kay Road, shortened down from its full name Karangahape Road, is a must. A daytime visit equals explosive coffee, mouth-watering brunch and boutique shopping, while the nighttime offers something a little more chaotic. Kay Road slowly made itself notorious through the 80s with the relentless growth of sex shops and gay bars, and while the sun goes down, the chaotic vibe that once overwhelmed the street still resonates, but this time it's chic. Expect venues hosting live bands, clubs pumping out techno beats, and bars offering cocktails, local wine, and beer. For Monocle in Auckland, I'm Claire Urban.
Thanks, Claire, and a very happy new year to you if you are listening over in Auckland. You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back next to discuss whether the First World War centenary is going to be a blessing for publishing or a curse.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Miller, and Emma Nelson. Now, one of the pleasures of the holiday season, one of the few pleasures I'd have said, is the time to spend alone with a book. And there are publications coming out in January which hope to keep us curled up on our sofas a little while longer.
2014 marks the centenary of the First World War, so there is bound to be a swathe of new books connected to that theme. So to go through some of these releases, and a few more besides, we're delighted to say that Kathy Rensenbrick, who is books editor for the Bookseller magazine, joins us once again in the studio. Thank you very much indeed for coming, Kathy. A very happy new year to you. You have brought a swathe of books in to do with the First World War, which is up until now has been a kind of a niche market, hasn't it? Especially in fiction. It's been Pat Barker and Sebastian Faulx, and they've kind of been the ones who've kept the war, the Great War, very much in the literary consciousness for the last couple of decades. Is this all going to change this year?
Yes, that's an interesting point. I mean, I think it's a staple. People remain interested in it. I'm very interested in war literature because I think people are often at their most extreme, and that's possibly why it's so interesting. But yes, there's going to be a whole new set of books coming through this year, lots of which are very, very good indeed.
How difficult is it, though, for a book about a particular subject, especially an anniversary, to become to stand out? I mean, I ask myself, because about 5 years ago, I had an idea which I punted to my own Australian publisher for a book related to 1915, which will be a bigger deal in Australia because that's the 100th anniversary of the first Anzac Day. And in 2010, they just went, that's a good idea, but oh dear God, no.
There's already too many. Yes. It's that thing. So obviously somebody sits down and says, you know, it would be a really good idea if we had some books about this. And then at some point it's like, no, now we've got too many.
Yeah. are these books, both of the two books you have brought in, the two great war-related novels, both of which look excellent, are they actually taking a bit of a risk coming out this year?
No, I don't think so. I think actually what would depress me if I was listening to the programme is if I was an author that had a half-written book about the First World War. I think that probably would...
Well, if you've got a half-written book, you'd better get moving on the second half at this point.
I think at the moment, probably people will be thinking, oh, we might have had enough of First World War novels during this year coming up. So I wouldn't necessarily... If somebody's wondering about what to start writing their great novel about, I wouldn't necessarily suggest the First World War.
Yeah, transpose it to the Irish Civil War. That gives you another 7 years to play with.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Fewer countries involved, though.
Exactly, smaller market, sadly.
Let's start then with Anna Hope and Wake. It is a book which is written by a woman who is hotly tipped. This is a debut novel, and yet you've brought it in to say that this is going to be one of the great ones of the year.
I think it's a very, very, very good book indeed. And
why?
I think she's taken a really interesting premise, which is it's set around the unknown soldier. So, and I didn't know this before reading the novel, but the way the unknown soldier was found was that bodies were disinterred in France. They chose an anonymous body and then they brought it back to England over the course of 5 days. And then there was this huge ceremony at the cenotaph. And all these people, lots of whom women, came and did look on this unknown soldier, this body, this ceremony, as a chance to mark the departure of their own loved one, their own son, their own brother, their own husband. All these people who'd been denied the usual and normal rituals of death looked at this as a point at which they could possibly move forward. And that's the premise of the novel. So it starts with the disinterment of the body in northern France.
It's an incredibly emotive subject to start off with straight away, isn't it? And it's quite clever insofar as it doesn't necessarily plunge you straight into war.
That's exactly it. You know, there's no shortage of glimpses of horror of war through it, but it is focused on the women at home and how they coped and how they'll continue to cope, and also how the country will continue to cope. And kind of, I think the wider theme is, how do people get over trauma? Can you get over trauma? Will these people recover from what they've seen and suffered? and how is that to be done? And that the unknown soldier was the sort of the country's attempt to start marking that move forward.
But that question of trauma is, of course, the big one from which you extrapolate the First World War's effect on the entire 20th century, mm-hmm. which followed it. It was the great defining trauma yeah. of that era. And certainly in Australia, it has where I grew up, it has a much greater resonance than any conflict since. And mm-hmm. I think, yeah, the publishing onslaught in Australia next year will be something to behold. But I want to move along as well to Helen Dunmore's World War One novel, The Lie, the title obviously evocative of the Wilfred Owen poem, Dulce et Decorum Est, and also of the Rudyard Kipling quote, which forms the epigraph, Kipling's son, of course, killed on the Western Front. Is this a different way of tackling it? Is this more interested in the soldiering part of the First World War?
So the principal character here is a soldier, Daniel. So and this novel opens on the Cornish coast in 1920. So again, the same time frame, and it's the same premise, looking back at what happened and asking the question, can you ever get over it? I love Helen Dunmore's books, and she's interested in war, and she's interested in recovery, and she's interested in Cornwall. So this book takes us back to some of the sort of her recurring points of interest. And I think this is just a wonderful novel. This is punctuated. The chapter starts. The headings of each chapter are taken from the documentation at the time, notes for infantry officers. And that's a very clever device because you're continually given the, you know, dead, disposal of, and the notes around the sort of formalities of how things are done are all woven into Daniel's attempt to recover himself. But it's very, whereas Wake is filled with often quite a lot of glamorous detail about dances at the Hammersmith Palais, this is quite sparse. This is, you know, he's eking out his living on the land. He's making some not very good decisions.
How does this differ from the, I mentioned Pat Barker and Sebastian mm-hmm. Fox at the beginning, who are two novelists who deal very much with the psychological aftermath of experiences mm-hmm. in the First World War. How does this differ? How does this mark itself out as a fresh approach?
I think they're probably you could say that they're all more concerned with the home front and the aftermath rather than what happened at
the
time.
Than over the top.
Yeah. So it's looking back. I find it very interesting, again, to think how we as a nation are going to react to this centenary, which in some ways I think you could be quite cynical about. But just after reading one of these books, actually, I walked through London and Westminster and the Fields of Remembrance, and I was looking at all the remembrance, there's little wooden crosses in the fields. And then I just came across the modern ones. And, of course, they've got photographs on the little wooden crosses. And it all seemed so... It just was a very direct reminder that people are dying in conflict at the moment. So we'll be celebrating a centenary where you kind of think, well, surely that sort of thing doesn't happen anymore, with the constant reminder that actually it does happen and people are actually having to make these same... People are still having to make the same emotional recoveries that they were making in 1920.
And how have publishers approached this? Because you've obviously just described a very tricky balance that needs to be struck. Mm. When you've been talking to publishers and authors, what is the line that many have decided to follow?
I think that's a very interesting question, and there probably isn't a simple answer to it because there probably isn't a simple answer to it. And I think that will be really interesting again to see how the war, how the year progresses. Is it, because it isn't historical, is it, in the sense that it's not like if we were talking about the Battle of Hastings, say, I wouldn't feel I have to be respectful of the people involved. Whereas the First World War, it's still in our consciousness, isn't it? I think people
but
still...
It's also an extraordinarily ambiguous conflict. We've seen a huge political row happening here in Britain just this week on what should be taught in schools mm-hmm. about how it started. And it says everything, I think, about the Great War, that 100 years after it started, people are still arguing over what it was about. And that,
yeah.
it's certainly in the Western world a much more ambiguous conflict than the Second World War, which, if you're raised in Australia or America or Europe, is taught and seen quite rightly as a fairly straightforward yeah. clash between the good guys and the
yeah.
bad guys. The First World War, rather less so, which I think is possibly one of the reasons it makes it attractive to novelists.
And why it will be interesting to us, because as I was standing in Westminster Abbey looking at these crosses and thinking about the women in Anna Hope's novel, the different thing, how you would feel as a mother, how you would feel as a sister. Obviously, women can be in conflict now, but thinking about it from that perspective, and I have a little boy, and I thought, if anybody tried to send him to a war, I think I would actually be throwing grenades at politicians' houses. And I had this sort of sudden feeling of incredible anger that was very, you know, that felt very present. And I think those are the questions that we are going to be asking ourselves this year.
Let's move on, move away from the First World War. Not World War One, but First World War, is that right? You're not allowed to say World War One, apparently. It is not the done thing.
Oh, gosh,
by
I'm
all
not
accounts,
sure even
I, had, I was informed this week World War One is not said. We say the First World War. Not sure why, though. I don't question these things. Let's move on, shall we, to Donald Ryan, The Thing About December, yes. Your final choice.
It is, yes. It's not actually particularly happier territory, actually.
We have had a miserable review today. We've dealt with some fairly grim topics, yes. Both in cinema and in book.
I only quite realised on the way in the extent to which all the books I've given you are suffused with death.
Brilliant.
this takes us to modern day Ireland. This is Donald Ryan's second novel, except it isn't really. So his first novel, The Spinning Heart, won the Guardian First Book Award. It's a totally wonderful, brilliant novel about sort of recession-struck Ireland. This is his second published novel, but he's been open about the fact that it's actually the first novel he's written. To a certain extent, I almost think it's better, because I thought The Spinning Heart was wonderful, but I kind of almost craved a little bit more simplicity, and I think that's what he delivers in this book, which is more straightforwardly about one character, John Z. Cunliffe. It's called The Thing About December, and the structure is that it's 12 chapters, and each chapter goes through a different month of the year. So it opens the year, and John Z's a poor, lonely person. He compares himself at one point to an old Egypt of a crossbreed pup, because he talks about how his father was always quite, his father who's now dead, was always kind to him. But of
how
course
bleak.
You'd be kind to a dog, wouldn't you? You'd give it an old stroke every so often.
This is set in slightly pre-recessionary Ireland, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so it's further back. So it predates the territory of The Spinning Heart. Again, which is quite interesting, because, again, reading this, it's a horrible idea that you do kind of have all these people slightly... it's all going to get worse for them, but none of the characters are particularly redeeming. And you just feel...
You're not really selling it to us.
it is very bleak. It's extremely brilliant. But I gave The Spinning Heart to my father, who's Irish, and he said, I wish I could do his accent, could it be better? If you imagine a light Irish accent, he said to me afterwards, he said, that book is just too true. He said, it was so depressing, I couldn't crack a smile for days. I don't want to read any more of that sort of thing.
So out of your, your wallowing in death, your choices, The Lie by Helen Dunmore, Anna Hope's Wake, or Donald Ryan, The Thing About December, if you're very short of time, which one do you pick?
I think if you want to end up a little bit happier as well, Wake probably has the most redemptive ending. But The Thing About December is a wonderful novel, but it's excoriating and painful, but it's wonderful.
Brilliant. What's there not to love about that?
Kathy Rensenbrink, books editor for the Bookseller Magazine, thank you for joining us.
And with that, we must bring to a close our weekly review show. So goodbye from us here at Midori House, and thank you for listening. A big thank you to everyone who's contributed to the programme over the last 116 episodes, to our production team, Katie Bilboa and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager today, Alex Funnell.
And you can still download every episode of the review from iTunes and at monocle.com, where you will also find our other cultural content, Robert Bound's weekly culture show, The Stack, The Menu and Section D.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend and a great 2014.
It tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance, the watch that was born to race. Rolex.